Welcome to Ask the Investigator, brought to you by the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology. The JDD podcast illuminates timely scientific content through thoughtful discussion with top dermatology authors. Subscribe to the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology at jddonline.com to browse the current issue and evidence-based peer-reviewed archives.
This is the JDD Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Adam Friedman from the GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences. After a short hiatus, we are back. You're welcome. And to celebrate this return from the ether, we have a series of bonus podcasts coming right at you. This podcast is specifically supported by an educational grant from Almirall. With me for some lively and learned discourse is the amazing Dr. Jocelyn Kirby, who, like me, for a hobby, collects various titles such as Vice Chair of Education, Clerkship Director of the Clinical Dermatology Elective, and Program Director of the Residency Program, not to mention she's an Associate Professor of Dermatology. If you have not witnessed this Pillar of the Dermatology Community lecture, then you honestly have not truly lived. Welcome, Dr. Jocelyn Kirby.
Thank you, Adam. I am losing my crap behind my microphone right now.
Hey, you know what? That's pretty standard with the JDD podcast series. So I'm excited that it's only going to go downhill from here. So with that in mind, in thinking about crap, I would like to think about acne, because it is, from a pathophysiological standpoint, a completely biological cluster. And I'd like us to kind of maybe talk a little about some of the emerging concepts in acne pathophysiology, you know, some of the directions we're headed. And with that, I'm going to start with kind of a loaded question. Is there such a thing as non-inflammatory acne?
So I appreciate the really artful segue you took there. I was wondering how you were going to go to crap and move on.
I amaze myself sometimes. I'm not going to lie.
So I do study some other conditions besides acne, one of them being hidradenitis suppurativa. And I think the answer to my question is really based on both those diseases, where when we see somebody with comedones, I think risk thinking that there is not inflammation there. And we know from studies of the tissue that when you see a comedone, it is there because of inflammation in the skin. So my answer is everything that is acne, and certainly everything that is hidradenitis, is inflammation.
Yep, I could not agree with you more. And this concept is not so new. There was a JDD paper published, I mean, now at least probably 15 years ago, that really highlighted this point where this group took serial biopsies from an individual with what appeared to be clinically inflammatory acne, both from active and non-active disease skin. And even the clinically normal appearing skin had early signs of perifollicular inflammation. And I think it's important to consider all acne. And to your point, also, I think we talk about acne being a biological disaster, hidradenitis suppurativa puts it to shame, that all disease is inflammatory, all disease is damaging. And I think that we have to respect that. And if we take a kind of, you know, very slow or, you know, passive approach because we think that there's no inflammation, we're going to end up hurting our patients, because we need to get rid of inflammation yesterday, because even before we see clinical disease, there is damage to dermal structures that could ultimately lead to sequelae that we're not really great at treating. I mean, I definitely don't know the first thing about cosmetics, but even with all the fancy schmancy lasers and tools, scarring is scarring. It is very hard to remove that. And you mentioned HS, which obviously has very unique scarring because of that persistent inflammatory milieu. But we really need to think about all acne, even comedonal acne, as inflammatory, driving that follicular epithelial turnover, that blockade that leads to backup, and then all bad things. So thinking about that, and you know what I was just mentioning, how do you approach even something with maybe comedonal disease, either or, truthfully? I mean, we're focusing on acne, but these are cousins in some respect with, you know, understanding the pathophys, and even clinically there could be some mimicry. Knowing that all disease is inflammatory, what is your approach when you discuss this with the patient, and also your kind of first line approach with therapy?
So you're making me think of a patient we just saw in clinic in the last week or so. And he came in with a mixture of comedonal and more inflammatory papules, a couple of pustules. And his parents said, well, his friends are on pills. How come you're not giving him a pill? And this was after we were starting to talk about using a topical retinoid. So I think that it's a challenge I am not alone in encountering, which is that request and sometimes the belief among the community that, you know, if you don't walk out of your doctor's office with a pill, then they're not treating you right. And I try and help our patients understand that there is a time and a place for a pill. But for certainly this patient who is new to acne therapy, that we try and start with things that are just going to treat the skin and treat his disease. We talk about using retinoids because they limit that systemic exposure, but also we have more knowledge now that topical retinoids can also help with that scarring. And that's very often a concern, not only of the patient, but of their parent. So trying to sell the benefits and also the balance and risks for our patients, you know, but sometimes people do need more anti-inflammatory improvement. And I think there is a place for antibiotics to help these young people and sometimes adults, you know, feel comfortable in their skin and feel confident. But I always try and set their expectations up front, which is antibiotics are not a long-term treatment for your disease. They are going to treat more than just your skin. And we want this antibiotic to be a tool for you later on. If you're exposed to it for too long, your bacteria may develop resistance, and we don't want that to happen. So I think setting people's expectations up front and also holding myself accountable to how long they've been on it. Has it been 6 months? Because I really need to have an exit strategy at that point. Really, 9 months is way longer than I would typically leave somebody on an antibiotic. And if it's at the 6 point mark and I'm still not quite impressed with what's happening, and I'm hearing the same thing from them, you know, I'm starting to have the talk about isotretinoin and how it may be a better tool. They may hear me talk about some of the risks and wonder about that, but in the long run, I think it's a safer and more effective treatment.
No, I think you hit upon so many important points. Even addressing the new acne patient, I think very often we think of teenagers and acne, but I gotta be honest, I see more adults with acne just because of my patient population. And many of them are seeing a physician for this condition for the first time. They had managed it with over-the-counters, not so successfully, and finally they've come in. And I think the concept of, you know, let's start with something that biologically addresses the majority of issues, which certainly a retinoid does. This goes back to the biology. So in thinking about what I think auto-inflammatory might be a little overzealous in describing acne, but I really think it is, because what's happening is your pattern recognition receptors, the kind of gatekeepers to the innate immune response, are being misdirected. And in acne, we've learned recently, thanks to some work by Rich Gallo's group, that C. acnes contributes to this by messing with sebum, turning into short chain fatty acids, messing with HDACs, which regulate these toll-like receptors and the inflammasomes, and they just start recognizing things that they shouldn't be as foreign. We know retinoids suppress the expression of toll-like receptors. Some nice work out of Jenny Kim's lab at UCLA. We know that they can affect the sebocyte. Diatibatab has done a tremendous amount of work looking at the role of both, you know, systemic, but even, you know, topical, but even systemic isotretinoin retinoids in terms of their ability to induce apoptosis of sebocytes if they actually get deep enough. So I think you're right. If you were going to be stuck on an island by yourself, you could bring one acne medication that would be your kind of workhorse and would kill multiple birds with one stone. Sorry to bird lovers out there. A retinoid would definitely be it. And then also, I think you hit on something about compliance. You know, the parents like, well, all his friends have, or all her friends have pills and creams. I would love to know how compliant they are in taking all of these things together. So I think starting someone off with one thing that you know will address these underlying issues and the underpinnings of disease is going to make a lot of sense. But you're right, there are going to be many examples where a systemic is absolutely going to be needed. Antibiotics have been part of that for longer than I've been doing this, and probably even you've been doing this.
Probably longer than we've been alive.
That's a fair assessment. But what's so interesting about that, and you're mentioning, you know, exit strategies and timelines, it's a short-term fix. And that's how I explain it to patients, that the historical antibiotics we're going to use for a couple months, they hopefully will get better, but it's not going to have a long-term impact. And then they keep going these cycles. And, you know, you mentioned antimicrobial resistance, which we're definitely going to dive into, because I know antimicrobial stewardship is definitely your jam. But I think that given the way the kind of older antibiotics that we've been using for so long, because they're not specifically just meant for acne, they're used for skin and soft tissue infections. There's every time we use them, there's going to be increased risk for microbial resistance, not to mention just even the potential side effects and the frustration. You know, how many times do we have patients come to us and say, nothing ever works, or the medication I was given didn't work? And what you learn is they were on antibiotics for a couple months, it got better, they got off, and it came back. So even having that part of the discussion, explaining you have to have an exit strategy and this is just a short-term fix, also gives the patient realistic expectations. But to that point, you know, about antibiotics, that's one of the buckets from a systemic standpoint. You know, we have antihormonal therapies. You mentioned isotretinoin. You know, how do you speak to your patients about antibiotic use for acne?
So usually I introduce it as a suppressive, I think, to your point, where we're going to use it to try and decrease how much inflammation they have on their skin while using a topical retinoid, sometimes with a benzoyl peroxide or combination benzoyl peroxide product. So we call it the triple threat. And I need to compliment you. Not everyone says Diane Thibetot's name correctly. So you get extra points for that. So
if you could see me, you'd see me doing a happy dance right now, because I butcher people's mm-hmm. names like no tomorrow. I mm-hmm. can't even describe it. So yeah. A big win. Thank you.
It's a learned skill that we have to butcher names. So I tend to set expectations. This is something we're going to use along with your topical retinoid, plus minus those other things. We're going to stop it in about 3 months, or I'm going to reevaluate you in 3 months. If you're looking great, we're going to stop it and you're going to continue your topical. If you flare up really quickly after we stop it and you're using your topical, that says to me that your inflammation needs something a little bit more than just a topical. And if they rebound quickly, that's the person that I consider, in finger quotes, recalcitrant, because I don't want to leave them on antibiotics long term. And that's, again, what prompts for me the isotretinoin conversation.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think, you know, recent literature, and I'm thinking one particular paper that came out of NYU, where even after the AD issued guidelines and guidance of, you know, how long you're supposed to use antibiotics before giving the patient a break, which very short term, we're talking about a matter of months. Most people are still using it for months and months and months, even years on end, which, you know, it certainly highlights that paradigm shifts in clinical care can take a very long time to really manifest. But I think to that point, if it wasn't for the fact, at least in my opinion, and we're just, I'm focusing just on tetracycline antibiotics, you know, we can even get into, you know, I was amazed when I came down to DC, I had patients coming to me who had been on ampicillin for 9 months. Bactrim I'd heard of, but ampicillin, that was a new one for me. But antibiotics you would never think about for acne, that very little evidence, maybe just anecdotal. But I think because all these antibiotics have so many uses on and off label, you know, you don't want to keep challenging the microbiota in the gut and on the skin. You know, you're just asking for trouble keeping them on it that long. Whereas, I mean, if you had an antibiotic that was not used for every possible, you know, infection, as well as, you know, for anti-inflammatory effects, and we know antibiotics, you know, tetracycline antibiotics are used off-label for other inflammatory diseases. Obviously, your fave, Hidradenitis suppurativa, it's used mm-hmm. even though there isn't a whole lot of data supporting that. Right. It's used even for inflammatory hair loss, scarring, alopecia. It's, you know, the nice work that has shown its ability to impact matrix metalloproteinases makes it really, really useful and gives it a lot of utility for a lot of diseases, but that comes with a cost. So I think that's where, you know, if we're thinking about how are you going to keep antibiotics alive, especially anti-inflammatory antibiotics that may still target commensal organisms like C. acne that really do play a part, you know, that's where we have to go. We can't just keep relying on the same old antibiotics we've been using for forever. You know, I'll tell you, you know, for a long time, the reps who were promoting various forms of doxycycline, minocycline, they very quickly learned not to talk to me about pushing antibiotics for months on end because, you know, I would come back to them about antimicrobial resistance and stewardship, and that they'd kind of do the deer in headlights look and be like, oh, someone's calling my name. I'm going to go down the hall now. But I think to really utilize antibiotics the right way, we got to do sub-antimicrobial, or we need an anti-inflammatory antibiotic that's meant just for acne. I mean, that's, right. I think, the direction we're really heading in.
Well, and I think we can talk all day about, you know, we risk resistance. And, you know, rightfully, I think that doesn't resonate with all clinicians. You know, they think about patients, you know, what you could, so you're going to run a swab and show me resistance. What does that mean to my patient, really? And since you are quoting a lot of literature, I feel like I have to up the ante a little bit here. And so
I'll show you mine if you show me yours.
Well, on radio, that's fine.
That's very true.
I just dated myself. Dang. And I do want to throw a little tidbit out there. Doxycycline is, in fact, older than both of us. It was approved in 1967. So unless you actually know more cosmetic dermatology than you lead on, I don't think you were born in 1967.
No, definitely. That's thank God, no.
Yeah, what's the clinical relevance, you know, to our patients? It's that people with acne on antibiotics have a higher rate of pharyngitis. So, you know, nobody wants to be sick or ill because of treating their acne, and that's really what can happen. And the other downside is when we looked at people, not we, but actually a study out of NYU, Seth Orlu's group, when they looked at people who eventually were treated with isotretinoin, those patients very often had been on antibiotics for upwards of 9 months. So the idea that we're delaying the curative therapy, the treatment that can really interrupt scarring, which is that permanent sequela, that always reminder of, you know, what it was like to be, you know, 16 to 26. And I think your point is we are learning. So it does take a little while. It takes a lot of reprogramming for me to change the practice that I learned from giants in dermatology, but it's because science has changed. And so sometimes I've even had to talk to patients who I started on months of antibiotics and didn't set expectations at the beginning. And I just blame it on the science. I just say, you know what? There is new science saying that we should change this. And that's an easier conversation for me to have. It's not saying, oh, well, I was wrong, malpractice. No, it's that we know more now. And so I think blaming it on research, and that seems to be happening. Dr. Barbieri out of Penn, and even some work that we did, looking at these chronic courses of antibiotics, they're getting less frequent. So that's a really good thing. So shortening duration is one thing, but I agree with you, trying to be more selective in which antibiotics we pick. Not going to ampicillin, you know, maybe not using macrolides, but, you know, trying to go as low dose, low duration, and selective as possible.
Yep. Yeah, no, I think that I will say even a good sign of the change of times is, you know, for a period of time, I'd get these requests for refills of patients who maybe joined the practice or maybe were seen by other folks in the practice who had been on, you know, an antibiotic for months. They're acting for another 3 months of refills. And, the conversation is a tough one because that is the dogma they have been ascribing to, that, oh, I just stay on antibiotics forever. My acne stays away. And then I decline the refill. And they, of course, want to know why. And so if we are going to stand up against the potential, you know, I think antimicrobial resistance is certainly a hot topic and being a steward of this is important. But even simpler, being on antibiotics disrupts an important element of our both skin and gut barrier, which are the commensal organisms that are part of said structural barrier. They do a lot of good stuff for us, and we're killing them inadvertently. I mean, various bacteria can maintain the acidity of our skin. They, in combination with that acidic nature, they can create almost bacterial related antibiotic or antimicrobial products that will protect us against invading pathogens. Even things they make, and even when they die, certain components of those organisms help regulate our immune system. They, you know, once again, Rich Gallo showed that certain heat-killed bacteria can upregulate Treg cells to kind of keep everything in balance. So if we just keep wiping them away, forget even selecting for resistant species. And I think you're right. I think trying to wrap your head around, okay, so I now have a doxycycline resistant staph, but my patient has no sign of infection. Why do I care? I agree. I feel like if there's not a clinical translation, it's hard to really understand. But already in a disease of barrier disruption, which acne is, we're further disrupting that barrier. And that could be part of the problem long-term. Maybe you're getting the anti-inflammatory effect, maybe killing C. acnes, and even maybe staph might be important. There seems to be some evidence that the two of them go up and other organisms, their diversity and their presence goes down in the setting of acne. But long-term, you actually might be hurting that barrier further. And actually, there was just a paper published, I think, in the last month or so about minocycline and its impact on the gut and skin microbiota, you know, bystander organisms that after just 4 weeks of use, there's substantial changes. And there's plenty we do that changes the microbiota. And I would say that the effect on that is almost more immediate and more visible than saying, oh, well, you may select for some resistant organism that could cause a problem to you or your loved one or someone else down the road. So I think that, you know, the conversation of late has been, we try to get under that antimicrobial threshold. I know Ted Rosen loves talking about exactly how much doxycycline, for example, would you need to get in your serum for it to actually kill something. And below that, you're in that safe zone where you're anti-inflammatory, but not challenging bacteria. And that really has been my mantra. But I think now a newer approach is this kind of narrow spectrum antibiotic versus the broad spectrum. I'm just curious. I mean, I know you're on the circuit at a lot of conferences. Has that been part of the discussion of late? Have you heard that? Because I mean, it's outside the derm literature, but I think it's somewhat new in our realm, the concept of a narrow spectrum antibiotic.
I have heard, you know, more people talking about it. I think the great news is more people are talking about just being aware and, you know, not prescribing antibiotics for, you know, every inflamed epidermal inclusion cyst and, you know, evaluating wounds and to see if they really need an antibiotic. So just generally trying to be more mindful of that stewardship, like you said. You know, I think that we're learning more and more about exactly how sub-antimicrobial some of our antibiotics are. I very rarely use minocycline. I've had trouble finding really good literature to show that there is a dose that's sub-antimicrobial. Certainly a lot of people, you know, I'm wiggling my hand, waggling it because, you know, how sub-antimicrobial is, you know, some of the doxycycline literature really showing us. So I think the big lesson is just be mindful, keep it in mind. Think about how long you've been on it. Do the least harm possible, both in duration and certainly in how broad the spectrum is. And protecting that good bacteria is something that our patients are thinking about. So I wonder how often people, you know, listening to this have said, you know, maybe an antibiotic forever isn't a great idea. We don't want to injure your good bacteria. And you actually see your patient's head shake because they are thinking about that with us.
Well, I agree. I think, you know, Dr. Google for Change has probably helped us in that respect in terms of maybe too much scaring patients about being on, whether it be topical or oral antibiotics. Right there, I think there was a long period where any little thing, if you don't get antibiotic on your way out, it was a failed visit. I think patients are being a little more conscientious. It kind of probably fits into some of the things that drive us a little nuts, like natural equals safe. I don't want synthetic. But the good news, I think part of that discussion is I don't want an antibiotic. And I will say my experience has been when I agree with them on that, you know what, you're right. We don't want to use antibiotics. We need to be very purposeful with them. Something kind of magical happens because they feel validated because their expectation is we're going to say, oh God, another tree hugger. You love natural, blah, blah, blah. Like they expect you to reject them because we are the, you know, on a pedestal, allopathic, not, you know, never accepting non-traditional approaches. So on that respect, you can definitely partner with your patient and say, I agree, you know, antibiotics used inappropriately is definitely not helpful for anybody. And I think that's where, you know, once again, the discussion of narrow spectrum, purposely designed antibiotics for specifically acne versus for a lot of different indications is helpful. I mean, I've had that conversation, you know, with patients who maybe weren't ready to pull the trigger on isotretinoin or just wanted to know what all the options were. And I definitely have been very hesitant to use antibiotics. And you mentioned minocycline. I can't remember the last time I prescribed it for acne due to an N of one experience, which is not scientific, but, you know, I'm sure you could relate. There's certain circumstances that change the way you practice. I had a patient mm-hmm. develop autoimmune pancreatitis on minocycline. Mm-hmm. Now, can I prove it was related to that? No. but it takes just one to change your perspective. And I also never super impressed. I always found doxycycline to be a little more anti-inflammatory. There's no risk for any hyperpigmentation as we do see with perpetual use of minocycline. So, it could take one little thing to really drive that decision-making. But even then, I tried really not to use doxycycline. But I think I have found myself using the new tetracycline, sarecycline, a little bit more because of that story and the data available to us in terms of, you know, minimal inhibitory concentration data that really you would need a ton of it to kill organisms that we should not be even considering when you're targeting acne. I've talked with patients about that and they do get it. So I think that it has kind of revived my interest in using antibiotics. And I will say not just in acne, even that's what it's indicated for. I certainly have used it off label if of course I can get it covered, which is certainly a struggle in certain patient populations. But I think you're right. You know, people are more mindful of this. I hope our colleagues are more mindful of this. And they're really using them in a way that will minimize that disruption, but also, of course, creating another super bug, which we obviously don't want to do.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think one of the other, you know, challenges with the antibiotics comes from keeping them, you know, adherence. We talked about, you know, giving people too many things to do at once, but also some of the side effects of antibiotics. So I wonder what your thoughts are on food and tetracycline antibiotics.
Yeah, I typically stick with doxy, and now I've been using a little more sarecycline. Now, I will say also from a compliance standpoint, the once a day dosing definitely makes it easier. Mm-hmm. A lot of that labeling, as my understanding is really held over from the tetracycline era.
The original.
The orig, yeah, the OG. That was, I don't think I've ever actually prescribed it. Because I didn't have to, but I just remember learning about the limitations of its use and it sounds so annoying. Mm-hmm. I actually instruct my patients to take, doxycycline with a meal, to limit GI upset. Sarecycline, at least from the data, seems to be a little less, GI impactful. Mm-hmm. But I just say, take it with food. And you know, at least the data supports that you should be able to do so. You know, calcium heavy products should be avoided, but I would rather the patient feel okay. And maybe if you know, the worst thing that happens is they just don't absorb enough of it, you know, you don't get the full package. So I'd rather them tolerate it than to take it on empty stomach and then throw it right back up, which I've had many patients do when they actually get the bottle. It says, do not take with a meal, even though I've told them to do it because it's like a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode, doctor, pharmacist, and the pharmacist told them not to take it with food. So I'm like, thank you. I'm glad we had that 40-minute visit where I explained how to exactly do this. So I think it, even if there is some impact on with diet and taking it, it's better than the alternative. So I am all for them taking it with food. What about you?
I am, yes, absolutely all for food. And I think part of that comes out of the old tetracycline data. Like you said, sometimes we're a little too broad in, you know, lumping, and I'm a big lumper. I love to lump ideas. So, but tetracycline, that doesn't hold over to doxy. So the absorption, and I looked this up just for you tonight. So I learned something new. Thank you.
I'm flattered.
Because I was telling people to take it with food. And then there are other people like that is absolutely the wrong thing to do. But the data says that maybe it decreases absorption by about 20%. But when I looked up the data for sarecycline, it had a very similar threshold. And the FDA said that that was not a clinically important decrease in absorption. And I think going to, you know, just my clinical experience, which is I'm not failing every single time with, you know, adolescents and adults who are taking doxycycline and taking it with food, we're still seeing clinical improvement. So I think that trumps, you know, surrogate levels of drug and blood, you know, any day to me. But to be reassured that while it might not be on the label for doxy, for both these drugs, sarecycline and doxy, you're going to get the drug in their system and they're actually going to be able to keep it down and be adherent. And I've had the same experience, which is I stand in the room and say, no matter what sticker the pharmacist puts on this bottle, take it with food.
And then they say, but pharmacist. you know, this know, this messaging kind of reminds me of just the kind of overall theme of that an FDA failure, think of clinical trials, does not equal a clinical failure. That, you know, just because something made it into the PI doesn't mean it's clinically relevant. And I think our primary goal is to ensure safety and compliance. Yes, efficacy is certainly in there, but if you maybe sacrifice a little efficacy to ensure the patient takes it with regularity, I definitely think it's worth it. And I agree. I can't remember last time I told a patient not to take doxycycline on empty, you know, not to take it without food. But on the flip side, we mentioned isotretinoin. That's also a conversation that needs to be had because at least the generic forms, if they don't take it with something with at least a little bit of fat in it, it doesn't have the same efficacy. I think it's hard to really avoid fat. But I mean, I'm sure there are certain diets that would. So that I have seen. I have patients who would go through a long course with, you know, at another practice, didn't get the benefits. And I just always throw it out. I just ask, I'm like, did you take it with food or empty stomach? Oh, I always said I took an empty stomach. Mm-hmm. And how much that played a role, you know, I'm sure the dosing could have played a role, but I strongly believe based on the pharmacology that probably it did have an impact. So while you can assure patients that they can take a tetracycline, not the tetracycline with food, it is absolutely pertinent to take isotretinoin with food, at least except other than, I guess there's a newer formulation that I've never once been able to get covered by insurance that you technically don't have to, but for the majority of the US population that can't get that, you know, certainly taking with food is going to be important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Well, honestly, Dr. Kirby, this has been super fun. Thank you for your insight and your humor and curveballs. I hope we get to do one of these again soon. This was a good time.
This was awesome. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks. And all you tuning in, we are back. Stay tuned for future bonus podcasts through the JDD podcast series.
You've been listening to JDD podcast, Ask the Investigator, the number one podcast for dermatology pearls. Our host is Dr. Adam Friedman. The podcast is produced and edited by Emily Lynch Fries. Our theme music is Designed for Life by Young Presidents. New episodes are available the first Friday of every month. Check us out at jddonline.com/podcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to talk to us about this or any other episode, email us at info@jddonline.com. Subscribe and review the podcast on iTunes or Google Play, and don't forget to catch our next episode. Thanks for listening.